Just behave yourselves and act like men.
Now you start using your head. That's not love. That's 3 feet above your ass.
People will come, Ray.
All right, don't try to strike everybody out. Strikeouts are boring. Besides that, they're fascist.
We don't stink right now.
You play ball like a girl!
You're out of here!
There's no crying in baseball!
High fly ball into right field. She is gone!
This is West Coast Bias.
Dynamite drop in, Monty. That broadcast school has really paid off.
Indeed. Indeed it has. We are back.
Yes, welcome back to West Coast Bias Baseball Podcast. I am Samuel Paul.
I am Adam Nelson. Remember to email us at baseballshowpodcast@gmail.com. You know the drill. Wow. That was a hell of a series.
It was a great series. It was a lot of fun. And
wow.
You know, I heard after the game 7 on Wednesday night that the Nationals tried to call Bryce Harper, but there was no ring. Congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. Congratulations to the Washington Nationals on a well-earned victory. A very unusual way to win one, not winning a game at home. In fact, neither team won a game at home. That's quite unusual. Has it ever happened before?
No, it is literally unprecedented. So, yes, no, you were not crazy for thinking that.
The only thing that even comes close was that the 1972 New York Rangers hockey team won a playoff game or playoff series, a best of five series. Without winning a game at home.
Right. And then 2016, right? The Cubs, Indians. That was the second closest to 7. But, I mean, yeah, 6 had never even happened, let alone 7. So
right.
It's just pretty insane.
It is. What do you think is going on with that? Is it people are allergic to winning at home? Or
it's interesting. You know, the last... few, what is it, 4 out of the last 5 World Series have been won?
The last time that team clinched at home was 2013.
Oh, right. Red Sox.
Right.
I don't know. There's something about it, and it's something that I was well aware of during the division series coming home. You know, when you're expected to win and you're at home, it's kind of tough, man. You know, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it shouldn't be. Historically, and if you just think about it, it seems great. Oh, we finally get to come home. But there seems to be like a lot of added pressure when you're not just the home team, but when you're also the home team and expected to win. When you're the 106-win Dodgers going up against a team that barely even made it into the postseason. I don't know. I don't know. It's tough. And then there's also something about being not just the underdog, but the severe underdog, which the Nationals were throughout the entire postseason, and having that maybe a chip on your shoulder, or also maybe knowing something that nobody else seems to, which is that no, we're a lot better than what everybody thinks we are. But I mean, man, wow. I mean, it was a hell of a series.
It was.
I was rooting for the Nationals. I want them to win. I got to root for the National League. Obviously, it was a bit sore. I was a bit sore, of course, after Dodgers losing, but it was. You know, I mean, we already talked about that before. It was a weird managerial blurb and blip.
Well, and, it's
Dave Roberts' very extensive, well thought out, analytical managerial career. The one time he goes with his gut, he gets burned. But they did. It wasn't like we were the only team that got beat by them. I mean, when you think back to that one bad hop ball in right field in the wild card game. I mean, that one ball.
That was the break that started this unprecedented run.
It's kind
of
crazy to think about that.
That
was it. Just that one little hit.
It's really interesting about this game is so often that happens that it's not necessarily the better team that wins. It's the team that is getting the hops going their way. that those
spoken from a true Giants fan right there. Yeah,
those little things that happen during a course of the game that doesn't seem big necessarily at the time, but no, they just, if they tend to go your way, you tend to win more games, and this effect is definitely amplified in the postseason.
Oh yeah, you know, it's like a do-over. Once you get there, yeah, you just start over.
It's incredibly hard to quantify too. I mean, it's, you know, how do you measure the magic that happens during these games sometimes?
Well, and the Nationals have been criticized for still having scouts, like multiple scouts out there doing old school work, right? Not just looking at the analytics, having a bad bullpen, mismanaging maybe even a bad bullpen, although I think the two go hand in hand. Dave Martinez's job was on the line in the press. I mean, according to like the owners and the GM, they were going to stick with Dave Martinez to begin with, but even just believing in something called chemistry, which nowadays is almost scoffed at the way analytics were scoffed at 20 years ago. You know, it means something. And
it does.
You have an old team, Los Viejos, you have these guys that are the oldest team in baseball. I mean, you know, aggregate age. You don't think that they're even going to make it to October, let alone through October, you know?
But it goes to show what can happen when you get out of a bad relationship.
Oh, yeah. You still talking about Bryce Harper?
Of course I'm talking about Bryce Harper. I mean, that guy, I'm not calling Bryce Harper a bad person or a bad player
clown question,
or anything. It's really amazing that...
But you're calling him diseased and plagued. Is that what you're saying?
I'm calling him maybe perhaps a clubhouse cancer.
Oh, I thought you were more... Tuberculosis, you know, I mean,
he's a me first kind of player.
I mean, that's what it seems like. I mean, and maybe now we kind of know that maybe that was the. I mean, we'll never know. Nobody will know.
No one will ever know.
But reporter will ever really know.
But
right?
This is also a thing. One of the knocks on Barry Bonds. Barry Bonds was on some very good teams that won a lot of games, and he produced a lot of wins, a lot of runs, a lot of home runs. But when it came to the postseason, except for the notable exception of 2002, which they still lost, he really underperformed in the postseason. And it wasn't until 3 years after Bonds was no longer with the team that the Giants won a World Series.
It's true, man. I think maybe you're right. You know, you can't, certain things are not quantifiable. You can't put a price on everything necessarily. You can look back to, of course, the same storyline everybody's been talking about, but May 23rd, they're, you know, 50 games into the season. And they found themselves 12 games under 500, the exact same record as the Tigers. Tigers went on to lose 114. Nationals go on to win it all. Chemistry, clubhouse atmosphere, a manager that is on your side.
A will to win, a want to win and to play hard every day.
And playing baseball with your eyes. You know, there's something to be said about that. Dave Martinez managed the hell out of that World Series, man. Yeah. I mean, I got to say, it seemed like no, like, slightly controversial move that he made backfired. And, there might have been a little luck involved, but it's just...
But there always is.
And Hinch, it almost seemed like he was too analytical. And it came back to bite him almost every time, right? The one time he deviates from his intentional walk, he gets burned.
Right.
Takes Greinke out in the seventh inning after dealing in game seven. I mean, Greinke was unhittable.
He was having a game.
A one-hit shutout?
He was having a game.
Pretty hard to beat. So obviously, no team in history had ever had that bad of a record after 50 games and gone on to win the World Series. But of course, the Nationals did. Side note, actually, only one team had ever been 12 games under or more at any point in any season and gone on to win a World Series. You probably already heard because they've been talked about a lot. It was the 1914 Boston Braves. So, I mean, even that hasn't happened in that long of a period. So the Nationals have done things that no team has ever done. And this will go down as an extremely historic World Series, and one of the most fun to watch.
Absolutely.
Except for, you know, having to listen to Baby Shark for three out of those four games. But
well, the good news there is that it will likely not be a thing next year.
No, it definitely won't be a thing next year. But but I don't know. I say that. Who knows? The Rally Monkey, did that kind of... I bet there was still some Rally Monkeys in 03 hanging around the...
perhaps.
Or
but,
maybe, it, yeah.
But
there's
but,
no interleague play. So.
But, you know, a similar type song that was being played around the same time as the Rally Monkey, as we bring up 2002 again, was Who
no.
Let the Dogs
Oh,
Out?
God.
The Baja
I
Man.
Knew it. Baja
yeah.
Man.
It's the same kind of thing. It's an
You're
incredibly annoying, annoying song that
awful.
Everyone who is a fan of the team that's using it absolutely loves, but no one else can even stand.
Kind of like Don't Stop Believing. Yeah.
Well.
Although I have to endure it a lot because I hear it at least once a week somewhere. If you live in San Francisco or the Bay Area, you will
hear
it.
Well, there are also a local band here too, so there's that. But that lasted several years.
Lasted? It's still lasting. What are you talking about?
They stopped playing it in the
beginning
now.
Are you kidding me? They play that after every win, right? Isn't that your home?
No, I didn't hear it too much at the ballpark.
What is the Giants' home win song?
It's usually I Left My Heart in San Francisco.
But isn't that even if they lose? Because I feel like every game I went to this year, the Giants have lost, and I feel like I've heard that song.
I don't know. Maybe they just play it after every song. After
you know,
every
there's
game.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, that's interesting. Well, the fact that you don't know means it's either terrible or they don't win that often. So,
well, this year definitely they did not win that often.
Man, a little over 4 weeks.
I think
weeks
I only
ago.
Saw one win in person this year. It was a rough year.
I keep going back to that one, that crazy bounce, that little hop in right field against the Brewers, man. It's
that bounce sideways and fooled the rookie out there.
They were
in left field.
Four outs away from not even advancing to the postseason. You know, that's what you, I mean, it's so cool to see a team given a chance, make the most of it. Given another chance, make the most of it. Given another chance, make the most of it. Five elimination games.
And then keep coming back from behind to do that, too.
A handful of teams have won five elimination games in the postseason, but, well, we're getting all choppy here, huh? We're having some technical difficulties. But no team has ever won five elimination games while trailing in every one of those games. They trailed by 2 runs in the 8th inning of the wild card game against Josh Hader, maybe the most fearsome National League reliever in the game. They trailed by 2 runs in the 8th of the NLDS Game 5, of course, against maybe the greatest left-hander of all time, Clayton Kershaw. Then they trailed Wednesday. They trailed 2 in the 7th of Game 7. I mean, it's just crazy. It was can you call them the Miracle Nats? Is that okay? I think you can at this point, honestly. I mean, you know, I don't... That's kind of a... You know, and I knew after Game 7 there would be people saying that the Astros lost the World Series rather than the Nationals won it. But you cannot, you can maybe, you know, win 2 games on the road and get lucky, but you cannot win 4 games on the road and get lucky. They beat the Astros.
Yeah.
They beat them.
I totally agree.
The Astros didn't even play terribly, and they won 3 on the road. So it wasn't like, you know, they were completely out of it at all. Obviously not. They were the better team in the regular season, but as you were saying before, it doesn't really matter. It's the postseason. It's how you play now. And it seems like very few people are sort of saying that now. It seemed like at first a lot of people, maybe some salty people that lost some money. I saw one guy lost like millions betting on the Astros.
Yeah, well, that was the mattress store owner.
Right.
Had a promotion going that he would give free mattresses away if the Astros won the World Series. He did that a couple years ago when the Astros did win, and this was all his millions of dollars in bets on the Astros to win was an insurance policy against all of the merchandise that he was hoping to give away. But he's... He still gets all the promotional aspects
That's
of
true.
It, and he will probably
true.
Recoup those losses in just selling those mattresses. So,
possibly, if it doesn't go all Well, yeah, maybe. So just how good were the 2019 Astros? I mean, because this is something that's going to be talked about for a long time, obviously. Okay, I'm just going to get into a few numbers here because it is pretty insane.
Yeah.
Their pitching staff had an adjusted ERA plus of 127. It's just bananas. Their offense had an adjusted OPS plus of 119. That's insanely good. Over the last 100 years, there has been only one other team that had both an OPS plus and ERA plus of 119 or higher. You know what that team was? 1927 Yankees.
Wow.
And you know, that people talk about the greatest team of all time, whatever. People always talk.
Right.
So, I mean, that's the only company that they share. I mean, it's pretty insane how good they were this year. They won 14 more games during the regular season than the Nationals. Only two other teams in history have ever had that large a win differential over the team they played in the World Series and didn't win it. One was the 111-win Indians in 1954, which is pretty brutal. They lost to the New York Giants with Willie Mays. And the other was 116-win Cubs in 06, who lost to the 93-win White Sox. So, I mean, it's, again, really crazy. Easily one of the biggest upsets in baseball World Series history. Even Vegas agrees. The Nationals pulled off the third largest upset in World Series history, at least according to the spread, and largest for a team without home field advantage. So they're actually number one in that regard. 1990 Reds were the biggest underdogs to win over the A's at plus 260. The Cardinals in 1946 over the Red Sox at plus 220, and the 2019 Nationals at plus 195 over the Astros.
Well, and the Astros were like the sixth team with the most wins not to win the World Series.
Right. Yeah. Well, again, I mean, yeah,
it's pretty amazing that how good the Astros really were, and the Nationals. They outscored them, like, big time. Every single one of those games, it seemed like, ended, well, you know, perhaps some of those...
Game two.
scoring totals were, you know, maybe closer than the final score indicated.
Yeah, totally.
But, I mean, they all ended with, seemed like a lopsided score.
Yeah, because even Game 5, which seemed like a lopsided score for the Astros, really was a close game. They had 3 2-run home runs, and they had a guy on base 3 times, and they really made the most of it. But, you know, I mean, you can say besides that. But, yeah, I mean, when you watch that game, with the exception of Barksdale behind the plate, just making a complete mess of that strike zone, it seemed like a close game. So you might, you know, 10 years from now look back at the scores and say, oh, that was a really weird World Series. But it was a lot closer
than
the numbers show.
It was a weird World Series.
Yeah, it definitely was.
But it wasn't. The games were played a lot closer than the final score indicated in almost every single game.
So we're talking about how and why it's a seemingly disadvantage to be the favorite team. And it seems like that in baseball. Maybe in, you know, football or something, it's a one game. Okay, maybe. But... Sean Doolittle was quoted as saying, there was something going on. We totally felt it. We totally fed off of it. We kind of thought coming into the series that the pressure was on them. We could tell right away from the questions they got at Media Day versus the questions we got on Media Day. There was a totally different vibe to those questions. They were getting asked, what are you going to do after you win the World Series? What are you going to buy? And people were asking us, like, what does it mean to be in the World Series for the first time in Nationals history? And we were like, I don't know, it's cool. We're happy to be here. So we were very aware that they were the team to beat, and we were the biggest underdogs, according to Vegas, in the last 15 years or something. But you know what Han Solo says? Never tell me the odds. That was a direct quote from Sean Doolittle.
Love it.
And that's crazy, man. That's got to sort of mess with you. If you're the favorite team to an extent, what's your ring size? Like, I mean, that's nuts.
Yeah. No,
I don't want to be thinking that.
That is almost somewhat unfair questions to be asking a team assuming that they've already won right. the World Series before a pitch is even thrown.
I mean, these are adults. These are grown-ups. I mean, with the exception of, like, Juan Soto, I guess. But on the Astros, I'm sure they get fielded all kinds of stupid questions. And usually you can let it slide off your back. But they're also humans, you know. And when you get that sort of seeded into your brain, it's going to be hard not to think about that. Not to expect right. to win.
And start to press and start to do things that you wouldn't otherwise do. I mean, I just remember looking back at some of the highlights and Altuve against Strasburg in game six and being so out in front and so incredibly fooled by the pitch. It was very much un-Altuve-like.
It was because he couldn't read what Strasburg was doing, right? Well, you're talking about game
six.
Yeah, no, well, game six, he was tipping his pitches the right. first two innings.
Right, and then he apparently was notified.
Yeah.
And then he started randomly tipping wrong pitches.
And he started shaking his glove, yeah.
And so... Yeah.
That's awesome.
I think that's great gamesmanship. That's great.
So rad how he just straight up just said it at the interview with, was it Tom Verducci, like right after. And he even admitted, he's like, I had no idea. He's like, I didn't even know. And it was so subtle. It wasn't like Blake Snell? No, who was the other Rays pitcher that was tipping his pitches earlier? Somebody's screaming right now listening to this. It wasn't even that obvious when it was like above the letters fastball, below the letters curveball. Right. It was just like so slight the way he held his glove.
The movement of the glove as he adjusted his grip right. or whatever. Yeah. And the Astros are probably the best team out there picking up on stuff like that.
Oh, they've proven themselves to be, if not the best, the most vocal about it and sort of obvious about tipping right. and mouthing, hey, he's kind of doing this and that. But they are very analytical, right? Tyler Glasnow, sorry. There we go. All right, Jesus Christ, I'm getting old. Getting old. Sorry out there. I know somebody out there is freaking out. As I would be too, but yeah, no, they're the most analytical team, I guess, right, by reputation at least, and the Nationals are one of the least, and so it's kind of cool to see, man. I mean, I would like to pose the question: are we gonna go back now once we see how old school ball, playing ball with your eyes instead of with your iPad?
Well, you know, the game.
No, the game's changed. It's not. We're never gonna go backwards. But it is nice to see that a game that's 160 years old can still be played the way. It was played a century ago.
It was played for so long without these advanced analytics that there's all of the old school traditional way of doing things is not wrong. They're not suddenly passe and unuseful anymore. There's still a use for this kind of information and data gathering that can be integrated with the advanced analytics right. to really produce some special results on the field.
Well, I think the best example of that is the Dodgers. You know, I mean, they use old school ball, old school scouting. They still seem to find the best, up and coming players, or at least among the best. Yet they're also very analytical, and obviously no World Series in the last 31 years to show for it. But a couple of pennants. What? And seven straight West. Okay. Anyway, but
Watching Dodgers games, I still miss the guy with the radar gun and the white fedora.
Yeah.
He was every single game. He was there every single pitch.
Yeah.
But don't see him anymore.
Nope. Statcast took over. So now we have a 4D camera. I don't know what is this 4D instant replay like 4D. I can't taste it. Like, what's the fourth dimension?
Time.
Bullet time, the Matrix thing? Yeah. So, is there such a thing as the road field advantage? The Astros didn't merely run up the best home record in baseball, which they did. They were one of the most unbeatable teams at home in modern times. They were 60-21 at home this year. In fact, in nearly six decades since baseball started playing a 162-game schedule, only four teams won more home games in any season than the Astros did this year. Yes, sir. 62 Giants, 98 Yankees, 75 Reds, 61 Yankees. Wow. They are a home team powerhouse.
So what happened?
Shut down.
Yeah.
It's pretty great.
I don't know.
That was great.
You know, there may be, because by the time the series did go back to Washington, Washington had won two in Houston. So everyone was thinking, oh my God, we're going to be able to win this at home. Yeah. We're going to have a big party in D.C. And no.
Going into game three, I think it was something Vegas odds had the World Series even going six games at 5% chance. Like the Nationals were favored 70% to win. Well, not a sweep necessarily.
One of our coworkers won like close to $4,000betting on this series. Which
I call him a fool.
Yeah, it
looks like I'm the fool. Yeah, it's pretty insane. The Astros didn't even lose four in a row to any team the entire season. In fact, they didn't lose four games at home over the course of the entire season to any team except the A's, who beat them four times but needed 10 games to do it. It's just crazy, man. I mean, it's, again, all right. We could talk about the World Series forever. But
there's four games in a row, not just to...
No, just throughout the entire season, yeah, for in their home against them. Only the A's were able to do that. And again, it's 4 out of 10, you know, so...
Right.
Pretty insane. So, but yeah, when the Nationals went back and lost game one, or game three and game four, it was kind of that same feeling, like, oh wow, yeah, the home team has the disadvantage.
Yeah, as
I don't know what is it, like a social media thing? Is it?
I think it might, maybe it has something to do with the fact that, you know, the pressure shifts. Everyone in the stands is tight, wants to see a win, and especially in a place like DC that hasn't seen a World Series since 1933. I think that, you know, perhaps being able to be on the road, be able to take a breath, relax, and play your game because that immediate pressure isn't on.
No, it's true. That makes sense for the Nationals. It doesn't make sense for the Astros, though. That's the hard thing that I can't wrap my head around. But it makes for a hell of an entertaining World Series. And, you know, the Major League Baseball maybe probably always wants Dodgers-Yankees. Dodgers would have destroyed the Yankees. They probably would have swept them, and it wouldn't have been that interesting. This, however...
No.
was much, much more interesting.
Hoo-ah!
Anyway. World Series is gone. It's done. It's old news now. We're a little late with this show. Probably should have done it yesterday. But it's all right. Now we look forward to that hot stove. And before the hot stove even really gets burning up, we got some managers getting jobs.
Yeah.
What is it? Only a handful? What, two or three jobs
two.
Left?
Two jobs
only
left.
Two vacancies.
Out of,
I'm sending in my application, my resume.
Out of eight. Tomorrow. Two out of eight remained. We've already had six managerial hires. One, we think we already touched on last week.
With, Girardi.
Joe Madden.
Oh, Madden. Two Joes.
Yeah. Two Joes.
Girardi to the Phils, Madden to the Angels. Yeah.
Yeah, David Ross to the Cubs.
Sure, old man Ross. He was actually going to come into our potential trivia question, but no longer.
Well, the Phillies with Joe Girardi, I think I like that one. I think it makes some sense. Joe Girardi was a name that I had thought might be interesting for the Giants, but I don't think he was interviewed. At least I didn't otherwise hear his name. Maybe very early on, but I think it would be with his test. Of course, will be how he manages the aforementioned Mr. Harper. There in Philadelphia.
I think he'll take him down a peg or two.
I think so. I mean, he was able to deal with A-Rod, so...
Right.
Perhaps.
Which, very similar, I guess, in a sense, although A-Rod is a lot more vocal. Harper's probably... It's probably a lot more inner kind of thing, you know, clubhouse turmoil and stuff like that. Harper isn't really a big social media guy, as far as I know. Obviously, you're never going to catch him at a club drinking or doing anything crazy.
Right.
I don't know.
We'll see.
The Phillies are starting to wonder if there really is a Bryce Harper curse.
Well,
and whether or not their $300 million investment would be worth it or not.
Just $300? It was more than that.
No, I know. what's a few dozen million? Yeah.
Then Mike Matheny to the Royals.
Oh, that's
trading
right.
Trading in Cardinal
that's
Red
right.
to,
I forgot
for
about
Royal
that.
Blue. And
I like that. I think he'll be good there.
I do. I think it'd be good for him to be able to show that he really does have the managerial chops, not just taking over for a Tony La Russa team.
I like Matheny.
I do.
He's kind of old school guy, badass, you know, playing with a bloody face. Kind of thing, you know. That's what I always think of.
And his career was, of course, cut short, and his last manager as a player was Bruce Bochy. So he was a giant in 07-08 when he got hit in the head with a back swing of a bat, got a concussion, never played again. And
he's a tough SOB.
He is. And then he spent the remainder of his contract with the Giants trying to get back. And then he went to the Cardinals, worked for Tony La Russa, and then took over for him as a manager. So
not much success, but, you know.
They won in, didn't they win one with him?
I don't think they did.
They just got there twice?
Yeah. I should know. No, because I remember when he got fired, there was a lot of... and I think we talked about this on the show.
We did.
You know, he's not very nice to the rookies. And because that's just how baseball always was. You know, you don't give the rookies really the same respect that you give a veteran guy.
They got to earn it.
Yeah, exactly. And nowadays, when all of these, you know, this sort of trophy culture and everybody's a winner and participation trophies and stuff like that, it's a very, you know, and these kids are 19, 20, 21, you know, they're kids.
Yeah.
They're coming into a world that Matheny doesn't know anything about, essentially. I mean, he's only 49 years old, but the game has changed. The culture has changed, I think, dramatically over the last 30 years. I mean, hell, there's, you know, fences are extended all the way down to the foul pole. Like, they're banning tobacco in New York and all kinds of, you know.
And foie gras.
Oh, Jesus, don't get me started with that. But anyway, Matheny sort of had a reputation of being a little too old school in this new school world. It's hard, man, because to me, I like a salty old veteran. I like hazing the new guy. To me, that seems like how baseball is and always should be. But at the same time, that might not be the best recipe for winning ball games.
Well, it might not be. And he's now had at least a year off, though, to sort of think about things, reevaluate what's needed. He spent a year in the Royals organization, player development, and I think has a handle on perhaps who is coming into the organization, who's high up, who some of the young prospects are, and
yeah,
it should be an interesting situation for him. I also like the hire too. Then there's a couple of really interesting ones. Carlos Beltran,
sure,
manager of the Mets.
Yeah, I thought the Mets and Beltran had a little bit of a beef history there, but I guess they've let bygones be bygones, so to speak, and they're all adults, and he's coming back. Yeah, that's pretty cool. He'll be the first Latino manager for the Mets. He's got a 3-year contract with a fourth year option, which is pretty solid for him. Uh-oh. Silence your phones, kids. Yeah, and he still lives in New York, and this is the job he said he wanted. He didn't, as far as I could tell, it seemed like he didn't say or he wasn't interviewing for any other job. He wasn't even declaring any sort of interest in a managerial job, unless it's with the Mets, which is pretty interesting.
And I really didn't hear his name being talked about as a potential managerial candidate anywhere.
No.
So this is a little bit surprising, but
I don't know. I think people that inside kind of aren't too surprised by this, because I think he has been vocal about only wanting that job. And Joe Girardi, people were talking about Girardi going to the Mets. That was, I thought, the highest possibility, because that's what the quote unquote insiders were saying. But, you know, I guess they might have made him an offer he can't refuse. I don't know. And Beltran still lives in New York, and he's commutes to Yankee Stadium still on a regular basis, as he has an advisory role. I don't know, doing something there with minor league affiliates. He came up, or he was working with GM Brian Cashman. So he has an idea. I think he'll be good. Well, I don't know. We'll see. You know, you never know, really. Is Beltran a Hall of Famer? He'll be eligible in 2022. What do you think?
No, we'll see. I mean, I have no idea.
What do you think?
I really don't have a clue. honestly, I hadn't even considered him as a possibility of a manager. I know that he's seen a lot of baseball. He's played a lot of baseball.
20 years, 20-year career.
So I don't doubt that he, you know, knows, like, the game. He definitely was. But
I think he knows the game.
I don't know anything about him in terms of being a coach or relationships with players.
Right. No, but that's not what I asked. I said, is he going to be a Hall of Famer?
Oh, Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the next thing. No. He has a chance of being a Hall of Famer.
He's over 400 home runs, over 300 steals. You know, I don't know. That's for another episode. But what about the Padres?
The Padres
out with
the new.
I guess Andy Green was there for like 4 years already. It just doesn't seem like he was there that long. But trade one young guy for another young guy?
Yeah, well, I thought this was a very interesting signing and choice for the Padres to go to. Let's see, Tingler.
Speak into the mic, sir.
Yes,
Jace Tingler. It's also fun to say.
It is. He was.
Must have been a rough job.
I saw an interview with him on MLB Network, coming, you know, right after the hire was announced. Well-spoken guy. Looks like he is very analytical, but also enjoys the game and acknowledges that it's the. You know, the analytics can help finding the players, but players are still the one that are playing the game, and you have to make the right choices, put the right people in to succeed.
That's the job. He's 39. Well, he's actually 38. He'll turn 39 this month, and he spent most of his time in the Rangers front office in player development worked 2 years as an assistant to the GM. There, he's currently managing Escogido in the Dominican Winter League, and he speaks Spanish.
Right, which is I think it is definitely huge for any manager this day of age. Being able to speak Spanish and English, be able to communicate with the majority of your players. Seems like these days, most of the players speak either English or Spanish,
or both. Yeah.
Some combination thereof, yes.
I know, yeah. So that's pretty cool. Is it going to be enough to propel them to win the West?
Well, he's got a tough division to deal with.
The Padres should be good. You know, they started the season off great. I mean, maybe if Paddock stays healthy, maybe if they get all their other pitching prospects up and really MLB ready, I think they can be solid, a solid number two. Say the least. And of course, Fernando Tatis Jr. I mean, the guy's electric. So Padres aren't looking bad. It's a good time to be a Padres fan.
They've got a very good young team, and perhaps this guy is the right person to bring him up and have him be at least over 500 this year.
Tingler. It's going to be a lot of people tingling. It's going to be a lot of weird posters or signs in the audience.
Give me tingles.
Tingler. Like, remember like when Doug Fister was a... Anyway, so tonight at 2 a.m., or I should say tomorrow morning at 2 a.m., is daylight savings time. Or actually, it ends. officially, but at 12:01 a.m., Aroldis Chapman has to make a big decision. He's got to decide if he's staying or leaving. He has to decide by 12:01, whether he will opt out of his remaining two-year $30 million on the five-year $86 million pact he signed with the Yankees prior to the 2017 season. He'll be 31. He'll be 32 in February. And he's probably, it seems like he's interested in an extension. Should he opt out, the Yankees are almost certain to issue him a qualifying offer, which will, I think, $17.8 million for 1 year. He'll probably reject that. We'll see. I mean, you know, obviously his final pitch of the season this year was not ideal.
No.
When Altuve smashed it over the left field wall in mid-park, securing the pennant for them. But, you know, I mean, that's Altuve, and it was the Astros to lose, I feel like. But his regular season was pretty damn good, man, especially for American League. He 2.21 ERA, converted 37 out of 42 save opportunities. He's fourth in AL with 13.42 K per nine. Struck out 36.2% of the 235 batters he faced. And he also won the Mariano Rivera Award as AL's top reliever. So he's going to have a good home wherever he goes. Obviously, his fastball is decreasing every year. You see it. To live in the low 100s. Now it's in the high 90s, which is nothing to sneeze at. The guy's a pro. He's gigantic.
Right.
He'll be happy either way, but that's a tough choice to make.
It is. I still would be very surprised if he walks away from the Yankees and $30 million. I don't.
Guaranteed, yeah.
Me in that situation, if I was as talented as him and already being an established star in New York, I don't think I'd want to leave.
You gonna stick with the money?
Stick with the money.
Take the money and run, or take the money and stay.
Take the money, stay in pinstripes, and then see what happens. In the 33, 34.
Yeah, at least it's almost better. Maybe for him, he could just sort of do it now, pull the Band-Aid off, kind of thing. And it's not really free agency. I mean, I guess it is, but he's a little older. But, you know, Gerrit Cole has a similar thing going on right now, too. He's 30, right? Or he'll be 30 in June, I think.
But
Cole's going to be the highest, definitely, right?
It already seems like he has made his choice.
And, oh,
he's not going
exclusive.
To...
Exclusive. We got a scoop here?
No, but he's said that he is going to a team that's going to be west of the Rockies.
That, yes.
So it seems like he's already like left the Astros.
Oh no, well, I mean, minutes after their loss during his post game interview, Game 7, he wasn't even wearing an Astros hat. He was wearing a Scott Boras Incorporated hat.
Right.
So I mean, and he didn't make any issues about that. He's like, yeah, I'm a free agent. I'm my own boss. I'm not an Astro anymore, and he wasn't. But that's a pretty pretty bold move there. Is that going to ring unsavory to some folks looking at a guy like that? He's only kind of in it for himself kind of thing? Or does it even matter because he's a pitcher? Screw it. Be in it for yourself. Whatever. Just go out there and get over 300 strikeouts and go 19-0. Like, you do that, we'll forgive anything.
I don't know. Because the fact that they lost, that's one thing. If this was like... post game, and there, he's drenched in champagne,
right?
Not wearing an Astros hat, then I think there might be a little bit more.
Bit of a sore loser kind of thing, maybe. Is he pissed that he didn't get the call to come in?
That could be too.
Instead, Senor Harris, who was the topic of last week's trivia question, comes in, proceeds to not get the record. I'm sort of foreshadowing what we're going to be talking about, even though it's technically a recap of what we did talk about. I'm going to get all interstellar on you. But I don't know. I don't think it's going to hurt him. I think he's going to be fine wherever he is.
He is.
I would love to see him in L.A.
Of course. If he goes to L.A., I think he'll be more likely to be wearing red than blue.
Anaheim is not in L.A. I'm only going to say this once. MLB,
it's close enough.
Figure out your damn priorities. It's not, it's close. But 10 miles on a map is not close in L.A. That's still going to take you an hour. All right. To get from Dodger Stadium to Disneyland?
Hour,
yeah. Are you kidding me? Come on.
It's 2 hours anywhere.
Los Angeles Angels. Just call them the Los Angeles Angels if you want and bring back the old L.A. hats with the little halo on top. Or just call them the California Angels. It's fine. You can do that. The Texas Rangers are the Texas Rangers. The Astros play in Texas, too. It's fine. You can just call them the California Angels. Nobody's going to care.
Rockies, the Arizona Diamondbacks.
Or the Anaheim Angels. Even when they did that for a little while, it seemed weird. But at least it was geographically accurate.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just going to mail the Thomas Guide over to MLB headquarters, and maybe they'll figure that out. It might not be a good joke for up here. Everybody in Southern California knows what I'm talking about. It's okay.
I know the Thomas Guide. I know what you're talking about.
All right. Yeah, sure. There we go. All right.
And before electronic GPSs, I mean, everyone had one of those car, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So that's how you could actually get an accurate map of the streets. But
man, that would be so great, though, to see Colin Blue. And, you know, even for the Angels, that would be pretty cool, too, because they have maybe the greatest baseball player of all time playing with them. I mean, we'll see. Mike Trout. They got one of the most intriguing baseball players alive in Ohtani. They have the best current player, I guess, in terms of easy first ballot Hall of Famer in Albert Pujols, even though, you know, he's the shell of what he used to be. It would be the Angels need pitching desperately. Yeah, and I know they're cursed. They're actually cursed. And there's like a lot of demonic spirits around the Angels. But Cole would be pretty cool there. I would like to see him in the National League. I think if he goes in the National League, he's going to put up some insane numbers, which he already has, I think. But Rockies, baby. But really, we're burying the lead here because there's only one team that really needs him, and that's the Giants.
Well,
the Giants going to open their wallets?
I mean, it certainly can. It would certainly make sense on a number of different levels.
I mean, Jesus, the Giants... desperately. And can you imagine Cole playing in that park? Oh my God.
Oh yeah. If he can get 300 plus strikeouts in such a hitter's friendly park such as Minute Maid Field in Houston.
Unreal.
In place where going to a park where the ball doesn't like to fly is it'd be pretty amazing to watch, and being able to play alongside his brother-in-law,
right?
Would you know? Would that factor in? That
maybe he doesn't. Maybe he hates his in-laws. I don't know.
It didn't seem to affect Machado. You know, going to friends and family in Chicago when he made his choice to go to San Diego last year. But
well, maybe it did because he didn't go to Chicago. What are you talking about?
Right, exactly. Oh. I mean, he didn't want to go to Chicago to play there. He'd rather go to San Diego. Admittedly, the weather is probably a little bit more pleasant in San Diego than it is in Chicago. But
yeah,
especially in the winter. But you're not playing baseball in the winter anyway, especially in San Diego.
That kind of leads me to a different rumor that's been sort of passed around that's making me really happy, which would be Francisco Lindor finding some warmer weather.
Yes.
Now, this is, of course, a far-fetched rumor, but perhaps that's what the offseason's all about, right?
Right.
Toke that stove. Francisco Lindor, you got to come to the warm weather. You know you like it. Come to California. Just come over here. He's got the golden smile. He's just ready for Hollywood. In fact, I saw him in a commercial during the postseason for some, I don't know, Invisalign or Smile Clinic, whatever the hell it was, some teeth thing. I mean, come on. Come to the most superficial part of America, sir. You will be you will be treated with open arms. You'll be great. The only downside is that we might have to trade Corey Seager for that. I'm not ready to sort of go there yet, but ask me in a couple months and honest answer.
We'll see. I mean, Seager, a brilliant rookie year, and then he got hurt. And he hasn't
hurt again.
Fully
hurt
recovered.
Again. Right.
So you know, he hasn't come back to the form that he was his rookie year. The question is, will he? And will it be for the Dodgers to get that sort of insurance policy?
He swung at more pitches this year than he ever has in his career, and more than anybody else on the staff that played, you know, over 100 games, which is crazy. Seager was always the patient one. He's supposed to be the best hitter on the team, like all around hitter, and he was. And yeah, it's tough, man.
He's pressing, trying to get back there. He's swinging at pitches that he wouldn't otherwise.
I know, but he's the guy that doesn't do that. I know. It was hard, man, watching this year. I really thought this was going to be like the breakout year. I mean, I'm glad to see Bellinger have that year because he had the amazing rook. I mean, we had back to back rookies, of course, and then Bellinger had an okay second sophomore season, and then he comes back with a bang and in line for MVP and looking great. And I think everybody, Dodger fans at least, thought Seager was going to be that guy. And maybe he still can be. I mean, he's still young. But he is a big shortstop and old dog. I mean, well, so is Ripken. Man, what the hell do I know? You know? Now, you were talking about robo-umps, and maybe that's because Barksdale, and it wasn't even just him. There was a couple games during the World Series that were called very strangely behind the plate.
Yeah, there's...
They're nervous. I get it. But, I mean, you got to clean it up. Now, I never go so far as to think that I would prefer an electronic strike zone, although I will admit that with each passing year, the thought creeps into my head. I immediately shovel it out because I'm very good at suppressing. But it's creeping in there, which is strange. Again, I would never admit to it. I would never like to see that. But
I think some people are... It's starting to creep more and more into people's thoughts, and some people are starting to vocalize it. I've seen a couple of things over the last few weeks that suggest that we may be closer to a robo-ump system than most people would care to think about.
How dare you?
But, you know, the stat is that the season average, the regular season average for umps this year for blown calls, either strikes called that were outside of the strike zone or balls called that were right inside the strike zone, was about 9.1%. Okay.
That seems pretty good.
The postseason, they did get a little bit better. It was 8.3%.
Okay.
But we're still, that is still a significant number of pitches that all potentially can affect the outcome of a game.
That's true. Now, to me, though, I mean, 90%, if these guys are calling 90% accurate, that's pretty good. And I'd be willing to bet that that's probably better than it ever was 20 years ago. Obviously, we don't know. We didn't have the
right
systems back then.
It would be very hard to analyze that. But it would be interesting to see. And, you know, maybe perhaps there is still an element of it's a strike because I say it's a strike. Amongst these umpires, I think we might have seen that a little bit in that the Barksdale game that you're referring to, where there was a couple of blown calls, balls and strikes, and
I mean, the one against Robles obviously is the one that everybody's thinking of. Game 5, right? Yeah, I mean, it was a foot off the plate; it wasn't even close, and it was to ring him up. It wasn't like it was strike one or even strike two. It was to strike him out.
Right.
With men on base. I mean, come on, man. This is the World Series.
Because of these players are assuming the call instead of waiting for the call. Even though, you know, 90% correctly, if we could get it down to 99% correct, wouldn't that be worth taking a look at and taking the element of human error and a missed strike call or a missed ball call,
but there's still a human
affecting the outcome of the game.
There's still a human setting up the parameters of where the strike zone is. I mean, unless it's some sort of fluid. I mean, and I know Google achieved quantum supremacy or whatever, so maybe they can figure it out. But
the parameters are defined by the strike zone, the dimensions of the plate, and and every player entered into a database based on the height, so that the high and the low.
But what if they change their stance? I mean, just talking about Cal Ripken again. go back and look at all of his different batting stances throughout his career. He probably had 10 of them. I mean, the guy's every season had a new stance. He's a little bit higher. He's a little bit lower. I mean, is the strike zone going to be fluid? Can that even be possible? Do we have the technology?
Well, so far the technology I don't think is that far away. And the biggest knock on it is that it does have trouble with especially breaking balls high in the zone and low in the zone. So,
right, and that's those are the main ones that the human umps are missing. Greinke in game three? Yeah, he was throwing all these amazing breaking balls in the zone, wasn't getting called. ALCS now, I'm sorry. Which probably would have been called strikes with the robo-ump. But then again, if you're saying that the robo-umps can't even call those, then what's the point?
Well, it's not that they can't call those, but that's where they're having the most difficulty. This is still, they're still looking into this technology. It's not perfect yet, but it might be only 5 years away to figure out some of these kinks and get the system in and reduce the error to error to much closer to zero.
I thought the only thing I had to really worry about in the next 5 years was designated hitter being universal, but it's scary. But you might be onto something, man. Not that I agree. I tend to take a Clayton Kershaw approach on this, who said, quote, "I hate it. I think it's stupid." I think it's very succinct and pretty damn good. Because, you know, he's sort of talking about, you know, why, like, is that where we want to go? Is that how we want to evolve the game? Do we want to take more people out of it?
Well, then not
bring
even
more robots into it.
No, trying to come up with a way to enforce a fundamental aspect of the game, a fundamental definition of the game, to be as near to error free as possible. And balls and strikes are probably the most fundamental aspect of any game.
So what's a strike in the robo-ump thing? Does it just have to touch the zone? Like a foul ball? If a foul ball touches even 5%? As long as it touches the line, it's a strike?
I have,
that's going to expand the strike zone, if anything.
I have not found any detailed parameters such as that yet in my searches on this subject. But I don't believe that would be expanding the strike zone, considering that most umpires do give the black as
part of
the thing.
But are they supposed to? That's what I'm saying. I don't know what the exact rule is.
If part of the ball, you know, even just the outside
right.
of this 3-inch ball
touches
that line, it could be a strike even now.
I know it could
even
be,
now.
But is it? I'm saying now. According to the rules, do you know?
Well, I do know if the ball even, you know, touches the foul line.
Right, I know
it
that.
It is a fair ball.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
If the plate is a extension of that line, then yeah, why not?
I don't know. I don't know if that is the rule. I think it might have to be over 50% or something in the.
Well, I'll have to right. continue research, and this is not obviously a closed subject. And obviously, people who have been listening to this podcast for a long time know this has been an ongoing debate that we've been having, and I think it's very interesting to think about in the aspect.
Your ideas are intriguing to me, and I wish to subscribe to your newsletter.
Even Buster
subscribe to the podcast, and we'll be getting close. But this was, you know, not even the most controversial, thing with umpires that happened during this World Series.
Uh-oh.
We had an interference call that resulted in the
eighth manager in World Series history.
That
was I missed my cue. I was supposed to segue into that. That was my fault. That is true. Hey, Sam, do you know what rule 509.11 of the 2014 OBR rule 6.05K is?
I would believe that would be the runner's lane rule.
Yes, sir. Indeed, you are correct. It states that a batter is out when, quote, in running the last half of the distance from home base to first base while the ball is being fielded to first base, he runs outside to the right of the 3-foot line or inside to the left of the foul line. And in the umpire's judgment, in doing so, interferes with the fielder taking the throw at first, in which case the ball is dead. It actually goes on a little bit.
Right.
So, watching that game, of course, you're bringing up Trey Turner and game six.
Of course.
And a potential man on second and third, no outs, to then a man on first with one out. Brutal.
Yes.
Brutal.
Definitely can affect the outcome of the game. Now, of course,
it could affect the outcome of the manager's of life. I mean, the guy had heart surgery.
The whole series. Absolutely.
I was fuming. I was watching that game, and I was I didn't know what. I know the rule, but I don't really know the rule. I guess just like any other casual baseball fan. And now we're all experts on this rule now, I guess, right? Which is maybe a good thing.
Well, it's good to know the rule books of the game that you love.
Because after the game, you know, there's a lot of confusion because they interview Torrey and he basically says, he says the rule, and then he says, but it was a judgment call and that wasn't the rule anyway. And they said it was a good judgment, and I agree. Okay. But then A-Rod and Frank Thomas and, David Ortiz was a little bit neutral, but we're saying that no, it wasn't just the rule, it was a bad call, it was a bad judgment. Even Frank Thomas, who was a lifetime first baseman, sort of said the same thing. It was a bad judgment. However, I think after 12 hours or so, we all had time to, you know, relax. And the next day, you sort of realize that it was the right call. It was the right judgment. It's just a bad rule. I think that's where most people are at now, although I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I don't know that it's a bad rule. It could be that it's badly written.
Interesting.
That rule, my understanding of that rule is that rule is in place because back in the early 1900s, before this rule was put into place, runners running from home to first would purposely get in the way and interfere with the ball so they could reach first base.
Sure. I mean, all know the A-Rod slap. We all know that. I mean, that famous scene, and he was still safe because they didn't have replay back then. And I don't even know if that's a reviewable play. Yeah, like there are egregious people always talk about. The old Baltimore Orioles used to do that all the time. They essentially had to create the rule
right
for that. But the problem I have with it, at least, is that it gives no right-of-way to the guy who has to bust his ass going 15, 20 miles an hour.
He has a right-of-way. He has a whole lane to run in.
In foul territory. He has to run in foul territory. If you're a lefty, it's a lot easier. But if you're a righty, you got to get all the way over there.
All the way over there. It's 45 feet to move over 6 inches.
Cannot disagree that that is at least one step extra. That is at least one step. And in a bang-bang play at first, because every other base has a right-of-way and a lane, first base doesn't. You tell me that one step is no big deal in an era when we're looking at replays at least 2-3 times a game with one step, half a step even.
I don't think so. I think there'd be a slight adjustment in the line taken, but I don't think that results in an extra
step. Turner did not deviate from his line. He ran completely straight, did not waver whatsoever. He was in a lane. He was not in foul territory where he's supposed to be.
Right.
The ball doesn't hit him, it's fine.
He
hit the glove and then he missed the...
If the same collision occurs and he's 6 inches over to the right, he's not called out.
Right. because he's in the lane. He's doing what he's supposed to do. But then at the last second, he's also supposed to jump back into fair territory without breaking his ankle to get onto the base, which is in fair territory. The base is in fair territory. The runner's lane is in foul territory. How is that good?
Well, you're running. Okay, so you're running by, and it's not a jump over. It's just, you know, a step to reach and touch the bag as you go by.
Yeah, but guys are taught to touch the front of the base because that's the fastest. And Trey Turner always does that because he's a speedster.
So
he knows how to tag for his baseball.
So let's say you hit the ball and it's going to the outfield, the base hit, and now you move to foul territory to make the turn.
Yeah, it's round. Sure. Yeah. What about it?
So why would you adjust?
Because the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. It's not an arc or a parabola, which you're doing if you're going to second base. You're running straight, and if you're a righty, you're coming from the left side, right? So basically, I see what you're saying, but you know, who was it? It was A-Rod, I think, was even saying. He was like, we all knew the rule. The rule we all thought was dumb, but we were taught to throw at the runner. If you think it's going to be close, throw it at the runner, because if it hits him, he's out. Or at least no other runner is going to advance. The ball is dead. Yeah, I mean, that's crazy. You shouldn't have that in your back pocket. If you make a bad throw, you shouldn't be rewarded. And similarly, if you're trying to hit the runner because you know you're not going to beat him, but maybe you can get an interference call, that's even more egregious. And I think that that's bad for the sport, and that's not in the good spirit of the game. So maybe what you're saying is right. Change the verbiage of the rule. Make it so it has to be, because it still is a judgment call. At the end of the day, it's still a judgment call rule. But if it's egregious, like the A-Rod slap, right, or somebody putting their hands up or something, you know, intentionally, then yeah, okay, he's out. But if he's just running in a straight line and he has his designated lane, which every other base is allowed, and you have your own, I mean, you know, there's it should be allowed at first base too, essentially.
But you're called out if you deviate from the line going between any other bases.
Right, you have a right of way. You have your line. So how? Why is first base the only base that's different? And then you do have to deviate going to first if you're a right-handed hitter because you're starting on the left side. The next inning, Altuve did the exact same thing, and he ran on the inside, but it was fine. There was no bang-bang play, so it wasn't a big deal. So, I mean, you know, what's going to happen?
More often than not, this is not, you know, even an issue.
Right, but in Game 6 of the World Series, that's a big deal. Now, obviously, there's rules on display.
In some variations of this game, they played with a little bit bigger ball, softball variations. They will have first base be a double bag.
You are where
there's one.
Doug Glanville was talking about that recently, actually. Yeah.
So there's one bag that is unfair territory, and then the orange bag, which is in the foul territory, right, in that lane.
Yeah.
So the runner can run straight up and hit the bag, and that's what they're looking for. What if you just move first base
to foul territory,
partially,
half and half? Come on. But what if it hits the bag? I mean, the ball, that is, like, off the bat. No, you can't do that, because then you're going to also have to move second base, and then you're going to have to move third base, and then third base is going to be all messed up, because they're all exact, right? If you move one, you got to move the others. It's not like you could just move one, and one's 90.91 feet instead of 90 feet, you know, or 90 and a half. I think the only fix is either get rid of the rule outright, which I can see could have some issues. Guys could take advantage of there not being a rule. But as far as I can tell, they're taking advantage of the rule now as it is. Or you change it to where the judgment call isn't necessarily, is he in, you know, is he not in the runner's lane? Or it should just be whether or not he intentionally tried to hinder the throw. Because if you're a pro, you should be able to make a throw. You know, you see on a three-strike drop ball, you see the catcher run to the outside to give himself a better angle to throw to first, you know. Everybody should be able to do that. You shouldn't, and I know it's tougher for righties that are playing first base, and that's exactly what we saw there. It was a righty playing first, but it was a bad throw. I mean, let's be honest. And we're not even sure that he was even trying to throw at
it. And it was behind the runner.
Yeah. So I mean, as far as we know, he was trying to hit him because if he was, then he's happy and he got what he wanted. I don't think that you should be rewarded for not making a good play. I don't know. It seems like you can abuse this rule more than you can abuse it not being there, I guess. I guess that's the bottom line.
Well, it depends on who's doing the abusing. I guess there is more opportunity for a defensive player to abuse it.
And that brings us to this week's Ignoble Award of the Week.
We got another sad one, don't we?
It's a great transition, though. That's why I had to cut you off. Sorry.
No, I totally get it. I agree. I'm all for those smooth transitions.
I already messed up one. I wasn't going to mess up a second one, although I still did. This week's Ignoble Award. I'm going to wait for you to stop laughing over there. Do you want to field this one? Or?
No, you got it. You already started. Go for it.
It's tough. It's tough, man. It's old Josh Hamilton. Joshy, come on, bro. What are you doing? What are you doing over there? Now, I'm not a parent, okay, obviously. So, it's easy for me to pass judgment. However, I don't condone abusing a child, no matter what they do or say. You probably
or your relationship to that
probably
child.
Shouldn't do it. Probably. Again, there are some holy terrors out there. I don't know. But Josh Hamilton was I'm going to get arrested for this podcast. Josh Hamilton was arrested on an allegation of injury to a child. Just a day after, he was in attendance for a ceremony commemorating the end of Globe Life Park. He's been arrested and charged with third-degree felony injury to a child. According to multiple reports, the incident stemmed from an altercation with his daughter on September 30th. According to arrest affidavits cited in a report by the Dallas Morning News, Hamilton threw a full bottle of water at his daughter, pulled a chair from beneath her, threw the chair at her, carried her into the bedroom, held her head with one hand while hitting her legs with the other, and then picked her up by her sweatshirt, causing it to rip. According to quotes in that report, Hamilton allegedly told his daughter, "I hope you go in front of the f***ing judge and tell him what a terrible dad I am so I don't have to see you anymore," end quote.
That's not good. It's just not good on every single level there.
Pretty bad. Pretty bad. Now, obviously, he's had a history of substance abuse and, you know, he's divorced and strippers and cocaine claws in his contracts and stuff like that, you know. But this is like, you know, keep it to yourself, bro. You know, I mean, I get it. It's not easy being a parent, but, and again, you know, we can all cast judgments. We sit in our high up, but that's pretty bad. That's pretty bad. That's not just like,
yeah,
you know,
no, that's that
grabbing
that's,
a kid's
that's,
arm.
That's,
this is,
that's
yeah.
physical and emotional abuse and possibly the worst form of it too. I mean, I don't even know. There's also
a different candidate before a couple months ago.
Well,
a certain reliever that I think it can get worse. I don't know. I mean, now we're just talking about shades of terrible, and I don't really want to go down that alley.
No,
but no, I see what you're saying. I mean,
it's I don't know. There's also a restraining order on him now. Didn't
right.
Ex-wife and issue.
It's part of the bail agreement. Yeah.
Yeah. And he can't even be around any child.
Yeah.
Let alone his own daughters. So.
Probably for the better. I mean.
Probably.
Yeah. Jesus Christ. I'm a bad man. Yeah. Not that kind of bad. Sorry, that was a weird turn. It was just too easy of an Ignoble Award, and you know, the Ignoble Award isn't supposed to always be fun. Even though you're over there laughing your ass off,
I was laughing more about the transition than it was about the actual award itself.
Oh, your transition!
Congratulations, Dippy! All
right, I'm trying to lighten the mood now. Yeah, it was a little tough there. It was a little tough. Before we go, since we saw one title drought end, I'm kind of curious as to whose title drought will end next. Now, obviously, you know my pick. It's been 31 years.
Yeah, talk to me in another 23.
How long did it take the Giants to win the World Series in San Francisco? Anyway, the Braves 24 years since they won their last. The Twins, 28 years. The Rays, 22 years. The Padres, 51 years. The A's, 30 years. The Mets, 33 years.
Well, what about the poor team that has never even had a chance at the title? The Seattle Mariners. West Coast team.
They had a chance. They had the highest, the best season in baseball history. They had more than a chance. I know. Yeah.
But they haven't made it to the World Series.
No, I know. I know.
I mean, that's what I mean right. by a title chance. They
no pennants.
No pennants.
A lot of pennants, but no pennants. Yes. Or maybe not enough pennants for the pennant. That was bad. Maybe, really? Maybe I am a dad.
Just getting ready for it.
Son, if you're out there, remember to email us at baseballshowpodcast@gmail.com. Brewers, 51 years. Of course, the Indians, the most tragic, sitting at 71 years now. Mm. I don't know. Who do you think?
I don't know. Well, I think that probably the Padres will do it before the Dodgers.
Oh, how dare you. How dare... Okay, Machado. All right. All right, Machado.
Yeah, let's see. I want to see... I don't know if I want to see Machado lose all of the, yeah. my contract. I don't.
You'd
have a
rather
contract.
See Machado win
before the Dodgers? Probably, yes.
Rather than Machado losing his whole contract to that guy in the stands.
I don't know. I think I might be happy either way. It'd be
it's very, a win-win.
It's a win-win in my book.
How dare you, sir? I'm not too happy about that. But yeah, it's the Dodgers 100%. Everybody knows this.
Except for Machado, apparently.
Well, maybe. I feel like this. We took a weird turn there with that ignoble award.
Yeah.
And, I don't know. Do you have anything else for me now?
I don't know. Maybe Cy Young.
Oh, you know what? That's right. I'm gonna cut the organ short a little bit here because I completely forgot about that. Cy Young is coming on Monday, or at least the nominees.
The announcement, I believe, is scheduled for the 12th or the 13th.
Monday.
Yeah.
Right.
It's Monday already. The 13th. I don't know.
No, the announcement of the winners.
The announcement
right,
of
no,
the winners,
but
yeah.
the finalists will the be announced on Monday.
Yeah. American League, it should be fairly obvious, but...
So, over at MLB... Okay, no, I
you've lost your source already.
I'm trying to credit the guy. Tom Tango. How did I forget that name? Tom Tango? That's a pretty sweet name.
You're thinking about Tingler.
Tingler. Ooh. You know what? I think I was.
I award you no points.
Okay, so Tom Tango of MLB.com has what he calls a Cy Young Award prediction tool. Are you familiar with this?
No. Today is the first day that I've heard about this. This is very intriguing, interesting formula.
It is. I think I think it is too. It's essentially a formula. Yeah, that's been pretty accurate at predicting Cy Young Award winners over the last 10 or so years. I think over 75%. Now it's a strange, seemingly simple, again not foolproof, but good way of measuring it. You take Innings pitched. Divided by two, minus earned runs, plus strikeouts, divided by 10, plus wins. Now, you kind of got to throw the wins in there because these are still the Baseball Writers of America. They're still judging you by older metrics until they all die and we start voting because we are part of the esteemed media. Once I get my ballot card,
okay.
I might shake things up a
all
bit.
Right.
But for the most part, it's a game of tradition, and wins still come into play. And look, when you're Gerrit Cole and you go 19-0 during like the last stretch of your season, that's pretty damn good, and it's cool to look at. Now, obviously, I think that's the least important of the stats, but it is still part of the Triple Crown. Anyway, so take that relatively simple formula. And you get in the American League with 100 points, Gerrit Cole. at 99 points, you're going to get Justin Verlander.
And then it drops off
a little bit. Yeah, Charlie Morton's in there at third with 71 points, and he's basically tied there with Shane Bieber with 70 points, and then it drops off over 10 points after that. So really, it's just Verlander or Cole, and we've kind of known this for the last month or so of the regular season.
Right.
And, you know, I had Cole and Verlander on my fantasy team because I'm a guru, and it was just great to watch these guys. And when Verlander got that no-hitter, I was like, okay, that's it. I mean, and then he got his 300th strikeout as well in the same season. He got his 3,000th. Pretty damn historic. Of course, we talked about that before. Only one other guy's ever done that in history.
Right.
Throw the no-hitter is the icing on the cake. I mean, this third of his career, that's pretty solid. But then Cole just proceeds to be unconscious the rest of the season. And in my opinion, I probably merits the Cy Young over Verlander just because he was the best pitcher in the American League.
Yeah,
I mean, he was just ridiculously dominant. Nobody wanted to face him. No, nobody wanted to face Verlander. And I could see voting for Verlander just as easily as voting for Cole.
Absolutely.
It looks like Verlander, he might get it, though, because I think...
Despite of the new record that he earned?
What do you mean?
But he has now the record of most World Series appearances,
and you know what?
Without
a
win.
That was going to be the Ignoble Award until Josh Hamilton just sort of put it on a silver platter.
0-6 and 7 starts. It's
brutal.
Wow.
Brutal. Okay. And you could see it in his face when he left that game, too. And it was just, ugh. He knew that run was coming across, and then he knew another one. So no more bad-mouthing Clayton Kershaw, because at least he's got in the World Series. Clayton Kershaw maybe in the first two rounds, maybe not so good, but World Series, nobody's as bad as Justin Verlander, and now that's absolute truth. But no, they they already had to turn their ballots in already, so obviously the postseason does not matter.
Right.
They're due at the end of the regular season, so that doesn't apply. But I don't know. Who do you think? American League Cy Young. Who do you think's going to win? Who do you think should win?
I think Cole should win. I definitely would not be surprised if it goes to Verlander just because he's got the history. And I know that in some of these cases in the past, I know for MVP and other Cy Young votes, perhaps that the benefit of the doubt win coming to choose between two people, the guy who's already won it gets the more votes because he's done it again rather than just doing it for the first time.
Okay, that's interesting. They were first and third, Verlander and Cole were, respectively, in the American League in innings pitched. They were 1-2 with Cole on top in ERA. They were 1-2 with Cole on top again in strikeouts. They were also 1-2 in the StatCast quality of contact metric, with Cole leading that category as well. So I agree with you.
Who had more quality starts? Do you know that?
That's a good question. Well, so Verlander also gave up way more home runs, more than he's ever given up in his entire career, by a lot. Now, obviously, this is the era of the juiced ball.
Right,
so.
and he was very vocal about...
right. balls are juiced, end quote.
Yeah. And he's also pitching in a hitter-friendly park, as is Cole, but...
Yeah, and, you know, a side note, Zach Greinke did collect 73 points using this metric. However, he split, you know, his season between the National and American League, so there's only been one Cy Young Award winner to take the award in a year where he played in both leagues. He didn't go 16-1 like Rick Sutcliffe did in 84 with the Cubs. Now, the National League is much more interesting, and it should be a lot closer and could kind of go either way, although I think I know who's going to win, even though I don't necessarily agree with it. But using this formula with 84 points, leading all the pack is Jacob DeGrom. With 75 points, you got Hyunjin Ryu. And then 72 points, you got Senor Jack Flaherty. Now, look, I mean, it's different, obviously, because the AL has a very clear top two. The NL is so deep that you could probably make some kind of case for about a dozen of these guys. You know, obviously, other guys like Strasburg, Scherzer, Kershaw, Sonny Gray, Luis Castillo, Soroka, Walker
Patrick
Buehler.
Corbin.
Corbin, yeah. Oh, man, of course. Each of those guys have an argument to make. By the end of the year, DeGrom was second to only Rue in ERA, but he'd done it in almost 22 more innings and with 92 more strikeouts. He was tied with Scherzer in that same StatCast quality of contact metric, and he did it in 32 more innings. While Rue looked much better than DeGrom for much of the first two-thirds of the season, DeGrom's strong finish will probably bode well for him when it comes time to voting.
I mean, the fact that he's in New York also probably
helps as well. I hope that's not true, but it probably is. But Rue is throwing an old-school ball, you know, so if you're really into these old-school, you know, keeping the scores down and, you know, having the best ERA in baseball, I mean, that's got to count for something.
It seems like it should, and be unfortunate if just because he was slightly injured, had struggled with his health down the stretch.
The last month and a half. I mean, that's really what it was. He had a sub 2 ERA till mid-August, Rue did. And so...
I mean, if
it's tough.
It is, and if you don't give the Cy Young to Ryu because of the injuries, do you give the MVP to Mike Trout?
No, I think no. Bregman made such a big surge at the end there, because when Trout went out, he was leading Bregman by almost an entire point in WAR, and so people were thinking, well, there's, you know, unless Bregman can do something crazy the last like 4 weeks of the season,
and he did.
And he passed him in WAR, which is crazy. So, yeah, no, I think it's Bregman's, just because all things being equal, he finished the season. And you can't control injuries, but at the same time, this is just an arbitrary award. It's not, I mean, you know, it's silly. You got to give it to the guy who finishes the season. Anyway, Scherzer made only 8 second half starts with a 4.81 ERA, and I'm sure all the fantasy owners out there know that all too well. He dealt with injuries of his own, of course. Meanwhile, though, Jack Flaherty posted a historic second half. 0.91 ERA in 15 starts. But, you know, married with his 4.64 ERA in the first 18 starts, you know, it makes him a solid fourth, but it's tough, man, you know.
Right. You don't think there'd be some sort of upset like Arrieta over Greinke?
Oh, when Arrieta stole it from Greinke? Yeah. No, I mean, if anybody would, it would be Flaherty, because Arrieta, same thing, had that ridiculous second half, even though Greinke was amazing the entire season. But because of that ridiculous second half, Arrieta got the Cy Young. I still think Greinke should have won that, but... You know, when you make history, it's they kind of, you know, what have you done for me lately kind of thing.
Yeah.
So Flaherty, you know, he could. But again, I mean, 4.64 ERA. I mean, it wasn't like Arrieta's ERA was that high. It was still pretty decent. It was then just like, you know, ephemeral and ethereal after that, I guess. But it'll be DeGrom or Rue, I think. I mean, again, yeah, I don't know. Who knows?
I would tend to agree. I'd like to see Ryu get it, be the first Korean pitcher to get such an award.
And he was so damn good,
man. He really was.
Oh, my God.
He really was. But, you know.
When we needed him the most, too. I mean, really, you needed him to step up. Buehler's still a little green. Kershaw, you know, was good, but wasn't, you know, Kershaw. Rude really came in there and just cleaned up so much. Pitching in Colorado. I mean, just crazy stuff, man. Yeah. I'd love to see it too, but you know, what are you gonna do?
Make a podcast called West Coast Bias to try to balance out the most of the East Coast bias that we'll get when DeGrom actually gets the Cy Young Award.
But. Yeah, 100%. Because DeGrom, wasn't that good in the beginning. And again, if you're a fantasy player, you were angry for a long time there, as you probably should have been. He was not. Very stellar. Anyway, all right. That brings us to last week's trivia question. Last week's trivia question. Will Harris picked up 5 huge outs for Houston. This was last week, obviously, before the World Series really got into effect. He then had 9 scoreless appearances in the postseason. There have been 12 times when a pitcher has finished a single postseason with at least 9 appearances in a single postseason without allowing a run. The record, however, is 11, and Harris had a chance to tie it and then obviously potentially break it, and his will was broken instead, which is pretty tough. I mean, man.
It is.
Greinke comes out with the lead 3 pitches later. They're losing because of that. Oh, that's brutal. It wasn't even really his fault. Cole should have been in that game.
Probably.
Just a little sidebar here because I've been just,
best pitcher in the American League versus the hot hand.
I know he's never coming in relief as a pro. He's only done it once in college. I know he's never done it in the minors, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Who cares? This is it, man. Yeah. And Hinch said, I'm only going to bring in Cole if we have the lead. You did have the lead. All right. Anyway, now we're on trivia. It's okay. It's all right. It's fine. I mean, you know, the Astros lost and all is well in the world, even though they are West Coast. I'm not really supposed to be rooting for them. It's blah, 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 blah. 11. 11 is the record.
11. Yes.
And it's still the record.
It is.
Who is that man or woman? Could be a trick question. Oh, it's not. Wow. That's I'm going to spoil it right now.
Not a trick. That's good.
We got Joe Tabura in Menlo Park says, Brian Wilson. Wilson?
Yeah. I suppose that is a good guess. Yeah, 2010 Giants. No, I don't believe that is
incorrect.
Correct.
Incorrect. No. Sorry, Joe. We got Mike Thornton. Thornton? He misspelled his own name? Thornton? I guess it's Thornton. Could be Thornton. I don't know. In Carlsbad says Troy Percival. Ooh, okay.
Troy Percival.
02 Angels. Yeah, right? World Series.
Mm. Okay.
I thought you'd be still shell-shocked from that closer. No, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was, the closer was Fernando Rodriguez, though.
No, it was Percival. K-Rod was starting back then, right?
Was he? I don't know.
I thought you know. All you know, all you remember is the rally monkey. Right?
And wanting to smash it, but
no, it is not Troy Percival. And rip the monkey limb from limb. Yeah. Did you ever do like a burn it as like an effigy? Did you
I probably should have. It might have affected the outcome of the series.
No. So no winners, no chicken dinners. Now, what do you think? Do you have a guess for me here?
I do. I'm pretty confident in my guess. That is, Brian Wilson was close. Right team, wrong year, wrong player. I'm looking at. Now the name just escaped. Jeremy Affeldt.
Yes, sir. Ding, ding, ding. Jeremy Affeldt. You know, it's been a while since we had a West Coast trivia question, so there we go. I know. I was a bit surprised. I was thinking it'd be somebody else.
Yeah, he was solid in that bullpen all 3 of those postseason runs for the Giants.
Not unlike your lapses in memory for 02, 10, 12, and 14, I've almost successfully suppressed completely from my brain and body.
What about 17 and 18?
I did. 18, fine. 17, I'm going to kick you out of my studio. Right. Don't talk about 17.
All right. Still too soon.
Alrighty. That's it. Remember to email us at baseballshowpodcast@gmail.com
this week's
trivia question. Okay. Yeah. Okay. May I?
Yes. Sorry.
This week's trivia question. Well, we had a couple. Now, I was going to go with oldest player to hit a home run in Game 7 of the World Series because we saw Howie Kendrick hit that amazing Oppo laser to hit the foul pole, which was just beautiful. Oh, there's nobody else that could have done that on that team. Just old man strength, just muscled it. Beautiful.
Just right where it needed to be and not farther.
He's the 4th. That's not the trivia question. The oldest is David Ross. So there you go. Go impress your friends there. He who is now the manager of the Cubs. He did it in 16. The Astros.
The Astros.
Gerrit Cole. Staying West Coast. So Gerrit Cole had over 300 strikeouts this year, right?
Right.
Now, Verlander had 300, so we're not talking about Verlander. Only 2 other pitchers in Astros history have over 300 strikeouts. It's getting late. Name those 2 pitchers. Or, you know, name one, and if you want to name the second one for bonus points, you can do that too. How about that? Name one of the 2. You know, I'm feeling it's I'm very relaxed. The season's over. I'm going to go sleep for 3 days after this, and So that's it. I jumbled up the question. There are now three pitchers in Astros history to have over 300 strikeouts. Cole is the latest. Who are the other two? Name those pitchers.
That's a good question. I think I have one. I have to think about the other.
I need to reword that properly. I think you get the idea.
Right? I hope so.
There's only two. Now there's one that's probably obvious and glaring, although, or maybe it's not. I don't know.
Maybe it's not.
We shall see.
Remember, see any Astros fans out there, expect to hear from you.
Yeah, you know, we got to throw the Astros a bone, right? We don't, but, you know, I'm a nice guy, right? So we'll see. This is a good Astros question. That's it. I'm feeling good about that. Remember to email us at baseballshowpodcast@gmail.com from San Francisco, California. I am Adam Nelson.
And I am Samuel Paul. Remember, baseball is life. The rest, just detail.
Go watch some baseball.